timed it right, but maybe not. Anyway, good morning, everybody. Good morning, Joan. Good morning, Dove. Good morning, everyone. I have Bruce Rawls here on the line, and we are here for more cool stuff. And Bruce, good morning. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Lynn and all.
So, what's going on with you, buddy? And are you ready for the big time change that happens tonight? I sure am.
Is that happening this evening already? I guess it must be, huh?
Well, I you know what? A friend that I used to work with sent it out on Facebook, and I know that she is very aware of that kind of stuff because of work things. So I'm pretty sure it must be. So anyway, that's I'll check and make sure. So anyway, I was supposed to be going to a retreat today with the Awakening Together, and the ministers are getting ordained and all that kind of stuff. So, but I'm not going. And Brent Haskell was going to be there, and he's teaching a whole new channeling thing that he got. But I just, you know, I absolutely, without a doubt, know the guidance. And the guidance tells me, nope, you're not going, no need. So I'm not going. Okay. You know, I was surprised about that. Up until yesterday, I was sure I was going. And then last night, I was sure I was not. And isn't that odd how those things come to you? And yet, you know, I've learned to really listen to those prompts, because I know that, you know, when I've not listened to them, not only has it caused me a lot of agitation, but it's turned out that I've done exactly what the prompt told me was going to happen anyway. So it's like, you know, no matter what. And it's funny because the person who was supposed to give me a ride, after I contacted them this morning, I woke up really early and sent them a message. And after I contacted them, they sent me back a message and said, well, you know, I was thinking about not going. I was really thinking about not going because my dog is sick. And so, you know, if her dog was sick, that would mean that she would either have to leave a sick dog at home because she felt obligated to give me a ride, or, you know, something else would happen. But he's...
Excuse me.
But the dilemma has been solved, because I came to her and said, I don't need to go. You don't need to drive me, because I'm not going. And she said, you know, oh, well, thank God for that, because my dog is sick and I had a dilemma. So how would I have known that? Would I have known last night that her dog was sick? No, I didn't know anything other than I got a real distinct prompt. You're not going to that. And yet I think she would have actually, you know, tried to figure out some way to get her dog to somebody else's house or done some other thing. She would have done whatever was necessary to accommodate me rather than to do what her heart was telling her to do, which is to stay there and take care of Maggie. So, you know, the prompts are there for a reason. They're not there because something good or bad is going to happen to you if you follow them or you don't. It really is just to kind of let you know what's going on. And for me, it gave me a chance to bow out and her not to feel bad because she was disappointing me. So, you know, whatever reason, and I still don't know, it'll be fine. So it's all perfect.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah. As you were saying, talking about that, Lynn, it occurred to me that that's just yet another example of how easy it is for us to turn to our investment in the person that we think we are, that the idea of a limited separate self, and think that what we do in this world is important rather than how we relate to it. Rather than how we identify or not identify with the essence that's behind the form, that we call by so many names, among them, Holy Spirit, the Jesus of A Course in Miracles, I like our inner kindness teacher, but you know, the name isn't important, but that the memory that we took with us into the dream that reminds us that we never left perfect oneness, and that awareness then gives us the peace that seems to take the form of decisions we make in the world to do or not do certain things, or to you know, behave in certain ways, and all those kinds of things. You know, the countless variations on that theme, of course. But I think that's why I think we're drawn to this life's work, which is to remember it's about the mind. And I've been again reading through the frequently asked questions, and the one that I read again this morning was number 1071, and it actually addresses that very nicely, even though it's focuses on a specific topic. It always brings us back to that generalization that is actually very appropriate for me to do today, because I'm going to a memorial service, and it talks about, you know, our understanding of death and how we relate to it in linear time. And of course, if we think of ourselves as bodies, which obviously we're all going to do by default, then life seems to you know, have the cycle of birth and death as its you know, fluctuations. But that's because we are so invested in that identity that we made up, and it's just a belief. And the reason I'm kind of speaking in hushed tones is my sister and brother-in-law are asleep in the next room, and I'm trying to keep my voice down. They just got in late last night, so hopefully I can talk in a somewhat modulated tone here without waking them up. Anyway, does that sound like a good topic for you?
It's a great idea, and so let's go to the
While you're looking up, it's number 1071, question 1071 in the frequently asked questions of the facimoutreach.org website, if anybody else wants to read along with us. And you can find that by going to facim.org and then looking at the online resources, the reference material, whatever they call it there, and then drilling down into the questions where you have the chronological or numerical list of questions. And,
okay, and it was 1071, you said?
1071, uh-huh.
1071, okay.
Yeah, so I'll go ahead and start and reading the question. I think it fits very nicely because, you know, you gave a specific example about whether to go or not go to a retreat. Well, it's actually, it sounds bizarre, but it's actually no different than whether or not to invest in a body. I mean, and that's it really boils down to the decision-making aspect of our minds is really just one single question that's presented to us in countless ways over and over and over again until, as the Course in Miracles says, that we take the final step by not the we that we think we are, but the essence of what we are. We finally make the decision to let go of a separate identity. But there's a lot of intermediate stuff going on there. We can't skip over steps, as Ken Wapnick likes to say. So I'll read the question here. Is the decision maker in, quote, me, unquote, different from the decision maker in other people? Who is the, quote, I, unquote, who is responsible for the decision? The, quote, you, unquote, that A Course in Miracles addresses. On that same note, does this decision maker continue in some form even after death until he has made the decision to relinquish the separation? Would any progress in this, quote, lifetime, unquote, carry on? So, you know, just as we're, you know, no matter how we slice it or dice it, we're so invested in the physical form, the seemingly separate self that we think we are, that it's really difficult, and our resistance is so strong, as you know, Ken would say, to even beginning to embrace this idea that we need to be really gentle and patient with ourselves as we go through this process. And so, to look at the and this. The response to this question addresses it really nicely, because it basically said that, you know, we don't get perfect oneness. I mean, intellectually, sure, you know, we can get it, and that can be a motivating and an inspiring force or a vision that we carry with us and have glimpses of from time to time. But for the most part, in our everyday lives, we need something more practical than just trying to, you know, brute force in our mind the idea of perfect oneness because our resistance is so strong. So I think that the mechanism that's offered again and again throughout the course that comes to us in different ways is the idea of shared interests and ultimately shared identity. I like how this particular FAQ answer provides that kind of a transition between shared interest and shared identity that then leads us to perfect oneness, because it is sort of a gradual phasing into those two ideas. So I'll go ahead and read the first paragraph of the answer. And again, we're reading from FAQ 1071 in the FACIMOutreach.org FAQs. So the answer to that question about the I and the me and the you and all these separate identities starts out, when thinking about these kinds of issues, it is always helpful to recall that we are attempting to provide a rational context for something that is inherently illusory and originally spawned from the wish to oppose what is eternally true. And that's that gentle looking at our resistance, to look at our egos with not out of anger and spite, because then we're just using the same thought system to try to, you know, undo what never was. But if we can look with gentleness, with the way we would look at a cartoon, and not get upset by it, we don't, when we see Bugs Bunny or Donald Duck, you know, doing outrageous things, usually, in our sane moments, it doesn't upset us, right? So, okay, and this goes on. Our human framework of explanation is the only one available to us, well, as egos anyway, but as part of the attempt to deny truth, it is necessarily limited. Jesus cautions us about these limitations in different ways throughout the course. Yet he must meet us where we are so he can help us identify our mistakes and then correct them once we have accepted him as our teacher. So, right off the bat, you know, we are always given the option of this inner teacher of loving kindness and of a gentle release from an identity that doesn't serve us by eventually replacing with an identity that starts with the idea that shared interests and shared identity gets us home. And that, I think that's where, you know, when we start to question the we-they paradigm and begin to look at the discomfort we feel when we get invested in battles, whether they're based on around differences in politics or gender or religion or values or beliefs of any kind, or just any I'll pick one that's closer to home. It's like how to organize things in the refrigerator or kitchen drawers, if you live with anyone for any length of time, you'll find that the little household things are no different from the bigger world paradigm things, like ecological issues. Last night, my family was here and arrived, and so we thought, well, let's put something on it, a dear aunt and uncle passed away this last year. First the uncle and aunt, the uncle was Uncle Joe Brower, that was the brother of a very famous environmentalist named David Brower. So we kind of got a lot of that ethic in our family ethos, I guess you could say, just almost by osmosis. That and I think that's been really helpful. The idea that we're all interconnected, we're all one, and that interconnectedness, I think, is one idea behind the environmental movement that can be certainly misused by becoming a rabid environmentalist. I'm sure there are people that you can think of that have been there, and I've sort of crossed that threshold a few times when I. And mostly in the household arena rather than the global arena in terms of, rabid recycling kind of thing. But just when you watch, why am I doing anything that I do? And you look at that. Anyway, we're watching this documentary about Dave Brower's life, and it was very well done for a low budget film kind of thing. And it brought to light a lot of the things that he'd done with his life and his involvement with the first executive director of the Sierra Club, and then going on later in life to found the Friends of the Earth and Earth Island Institute, because he was, you know, not willing to compromise and that sort of thing. And then I was thinking about all the values that I have that have been inspirational for me at one level, you know, within the thought system of inclusion and caring and this sort of thing. But then also it can just as easily, you know, just like anything else in the world, can be used as a way to divide and to further grievances and victimhood and a belief that differences in ecological perspectives are important, you know.
Which, so those things, and here's the thing that is so telling about all of that, is that every single bit of that, those beliefs and those ideas, those thoughts about what we should or shouldn't be doing or how we should or shouldn't be doing them, every single one of those is based on a belief that something I can do can change the plan or the will of God in some way, that I have some influence that is going to make a difference if I choose to use it. And the insanity of it being that I believe that I can act in this world in a way that can save this world or change this world or make this world a better place or any of those things. And the fact that I am incapable of actually doing that brings on what? Dun, dun, dun. Guilt.
Yeah. And I think the guilt is, in a sense, is actually the underlying causal factor. And I like how Ken, in a lot of his work, Ken Wapnick suggests it's not the guilt, it's the belief that we were capable of choosing it. You know, when we start digging a little deeper, it's like, well, the guilt isn't real. But that's the inner shield of oblivion. That's the guilty, dirty secret that the ego doesn't want us to look at, because that's its foundation. And if we discover that the foundation doesn't have anything to stand on, kind of like in the movie Inception, which has in the deepest level of the dreaming, without giving the plot away too much, there's this really interesting CGI sequence, computer generated imagery sequence of this massive complex of buildings, multi-story buildings that are crumbling into the ocean. And I thought, what a great metaphor for the deepest level of ego's unconscious guilt. There's this structure that has no foundation whatsoever. It's not real. In fact, just the mere fact of looking at it dissolves it and causes it to crumble into the ocean. And what a a great metaphor for it. And that's why ego is so terrified, is because, like, if you look at its foundation, you see there's nothing there. And that's what brings it, Terry, is it's the belief that we have the ability to choose against perfect oneness that we're terrified of, because that's the basis for our separate identity. And the ego thinks that the separate, we're so convinced that we're so far down the rabbit hole that, you know, the separate identity is all there is, that we don't even fathom the idea that a perfect oneness is possible, let alone believe that we could become aware of that, even though it's that glimmer, that kind of memory of a shadow of a dream, of that, you know, the forgotten song hints at that, I think, in chapter 21 of the text of A Course in Miracles, where we see if you can remember, dig back in your deep memories. But we know that there's this calling that we can't put words to necessarily, but we're all drawn to it in some level or another, that reminds us there's this incredible innocence, incredible perfection that we all share, and then that everyone has, that somehow if we can just let go of our incredible investment in a separate identity, that will come flooding back to us. And that's the foundation for this unconscious guilt that tries to prevent that awareness from returning to us. And but that's something that we don't usually look at directly. We generally have to look at the things in the world, and that's where our shared interests, I think, and our shared values, and you know, looking at the we they paradigm as it plays out in our everyday lives comes into effect, and we can see that there's an opportunity moment to moment to look at everything in our lives as our forgiveness classroom and as our savior, as our teacher, because literally everything and everyone, that's the holy relationship. It's not about I have a holy relationship with my spouse or my siblings or my mother or my coworkers or my you know, the people that I meet at the grocery store or a rock or a tree or, you know, whatever. I'd add infinitum. The holy relationship is between the thought system that is my way home, and as it's represented symbolically, metaphorically, in each of those seemingly separate individual things or people or whatever. And then the unholy relationship is just my relationship to ego, my relationship to the idea that I could possibly take this guilt seriously and the world that is spawned from it. So
yeah, and here's also so important is to know that the reason that ego is so afraid is because the power of the mind is unlimited. The mind is unlimited. And, you know, once you caught out, you know, once you call out and notice that, you know, this belief that you have is completely insane, then the power of the mind just says, well, I don't believe that anymore, and I can let it go. Just mm-hmm. like when we were little kids and we found out Santa Claus wasn't real. We didn't run around saying, oh, we must have Santa Claus. Bring him back. Why'd you? Or maybe we, I don't know. Some people make that. But in reality, you know, you just accept, oh, okay, you know, they've been lying to me all these years, and, you know, Santa's not real. Sadly, that's what we begin to see. Oh, it's been lying to me all these years. It's not even real. None of this stuff that I've been afraid of has any power or can make any sense to me once I recognize the power of my mind. But I can't recognize the power of my mind if I keep giving it sideways glances and you know, being afraid to really look at it. So, you know, what Jesus is wanting us is to look at our own self, our own being, and our own connection to our Father, and to recognize that that is an unlimited power, and that it is absolutely available to me, and that I can actually slip out of this dream state into the state where I'm actually aware of my own powerful mind, my own powerful being. But I can only do that if I stop pretending I'm this little thing that's so afraid. And mm-hmm. and once, you know, when I started seeing how much of my life was a pretense, and, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, throw stones or anything, but I'm thinking about this. You know, I was supposed to be going to a retreat or a workshop today, at which, in reality, 99% of everything that's going to be happening there has to do with people playing certain roles, and that the role that I'm playing as a person sitting in a room listening to a teacher, the role that the teacher is playing by standing up there talking, the role that all the other students are making, you know, by either agreeing or disagreeing or being, you know, whatever. And the roles that we play when we go to lunch and we sit and talk to each other, you know, do we have a regular conversation with a person like a real person? Or do we talk about all the peripheral things that have no meaning and pop up like, you know, I went on a diet last month and I lost pounds and you know, my sister colored her hair and my uncle died. And I mean, we populate our whole relationships with each other with all this artificial stuff that has no meaning. And how many people, Bruce, do you know, even students of a course or even people who are serious spiritual students, who can actually sit down and just either just sit and say nothing because there's nothing to say? And you don't have to make up a story, and you don't have to say, maybe I should talk about my uncle, maybe I should talk about this, maybe I, you know, if there's no reason for it other than to make conversation or to keep the uncomfortable silences from entering, which that uncomfortable silence, it terrifies ego. Ego can't stand that, you know, right. Not being always having something to report. And so how I notice for myself personally, I have become less and less able to just bear that kind of relationship with people. I can't bear the kind of relationship with people that is just so superficial and artificial. And I want to have real relationships with people where, yes, you know, if your uncle died and you're sad, let us talk about that. You know, let us not talk about the will and how much somebody, you know, or whether or not, you know, they suffered or, you know, any of those other thoughts. Let us talk about the love that we have for each other. And, you know, Ken, once you start seeing that that is the real essence of what is here, then you're not going to be able to have that kind of bullshit going on. It's just going to seem like, you know, what is the purpose of this? And that's what I find myself asking. I went out to lunch with some people the other day, and I sat there, you know, just asking myself, what is the purpose of this? And, you know, engaging with them on a heart level, where, you know, I could actually I could feel that, you know, and I could know that. And even though that is still part of the artificiality of the relationship, it's still closer to reality than all the other stuff. And so, you know, and this is what happens as you get closer and closer, you become less and less tolerant of the mind wandering. You become less and less tolerant of all these things that you think are being done or you're doing here. And the me that this is talking about, I posted something on my Facebook the other day, and I got a lot of traffic, which I was really surprised, not because of a lot of traffic, but the things that people were saying, because it was from Ramana Maharshi, and the questioner says, how are we to treat others? And Ramana Maharshi said, there are no others.
I like that post, and I shared it, as you might have noticed.
Yeah. But then, you know, some people came in and started asking all these questions and bringing up all Dr. Hawkins and the measurement of levels and all this kind of stuff. They had this whole conversation went on my page that was so completely, obviously, a misunderstanding the original post, that I almost just went and just deleted the whole thing, because it just seemed crazy to me that, you know, people would have gone off in that direction from something that was so simple and clear. And it is simple and clear. But until you get that there are no others, so the treatment that I'm giving you is the treatment that I give to myself.
Right. And I think that gets... Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. You go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that kind of brings us back to that theme that shared interests begin to undo our investment in the unholy relationship, which is the investment in ego, and begin to, you know, reaffirm what is the truth. You know, what the real depth of any conversation or any interaction is that we all have you know, one goal that's the same, which is to wake up from the dream. And I think that recognition is what allows us to be in any conversation, no matter how seemingly superficial, and to bring forth a feeling of recognition that, you know, like the Course says, you know, the goal isn't to not see bodies. The goal is to see each other sinless and to see each other without... having committed the cosmic crime without having fallen from grace or from any kind of blame, shame game. and looking at that and seeing that, you know, it's the moment that we, like you say, you know, become mindless and are tolerant of our own mind wandering, we become easily invested in the intolerance to others, and that intolerance then can manifest in ways of thinking that, well, I just won't, you know, be with those types of people or whatever. I won't go in those situations, or I'll stay away from whatever. And that's kind of counter to what the Course suggests, is that we need to address everything that we encounter in this dream in order to heal all the aspects of it that are in our unconscious mind, which are really just reflections of that guilt that ultimately is completely unfounded. It's that those crumbling walls of ego structures in the Inception movie at the bottom dreaming level that we're helping to undo, because but only if we look at them, we see there's nothing there. There's just the ocean of peace that's underneath ego's ocean of guilt that has tried to build up around it, you know, and try to make it a bigger deal.
And the fact is that, as Jesus tells us very clearly many, many, many times, even though he says it directly in one place, you have made the ego for your brother and you're making the ego for yourself.
Right.
So that facade that I'm perceiving when I'm looking at this person and, you know, all their stories, all their ideas, even the way they look, everything is mine. I made that up.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't even look like that. You know, it really, nobody even looks like you think they do, because you're the one who gave them the look. You're the one who made them look that way, and yourself as well. And so the moment you begin to actually see that the brother is actually the reflection of your own thinking,
mm-hmm.
then it's really easy to see. And that's why that thing, you know, how do we treat others, is so clear to me, because, you know, I treat them like I treat the thing I made up, or I treat them like I treat myself, which I think I made up, or I treat them like they really are the Holy right. Son of God himself, and so am I.
Exactly.
And brings about the actual reality of having a relationship with a person. You can really have a relationship, a holy relationship with the Holy Spirit, not the ego that you made up for them.
Right, right. Yeah, and that gets us back to the mind again, which is really the only place where we're ever going to undo that, you know, outer shield of oblivion and inner shield of oblivion, then both our investment in the world as separate identities and, you know, deeper than that, the ontological guilt, as Ken Wapnick would talk about it, that is the underpinning and the fake foundation of that entire thought system that made up an entire universe. And like you were just saying, Lynn, it made up the, you know, all the characters that populate our dream and that we call life. But we have to relate to the world on the level that we made it up, on the level of behavior. But in the mind, we can begin to shift our emphasis to the identity of shared interests. So, and that's what this FAQ discusses. How about if I read the next paragraph?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Okay. Our primary mistake has been to believe that something other than the perfect oneness of God's love is real. As is evident in our reactions to everyday occurrences, we rarely question the reality of multiplicity, that we are all real as separate individuals. And I had to laugh when you a few months ago said real person is sort of an oxymoron, isn't it? That we're all real as separate individuals in a universe of diverse entities of all kinds, skipping over the ego dynamics hidden within our minds, which include the terrorizing fear that we're going to be punished for our existence as individuals. Let us look at Jesus' description of this situation. He speaks of it as a process of substitution. It has taken many forms because it was the substitution of illusion for truth, of fragmentation for wholeness. It has become so splintered and subdivided and divided again over and over that it is now almost impossible to perceive it once was. and still is what it was. That one air which brought truth to illusion, infinity to time, and life to death was all you ever made. Your whole world rests upon it. Everything you see reflects it, and every special relationship that you ever made is part of it. And that's from chapter 18, section 1, paragraph 4 of the text. So, I mean, that's a pretty potent paragraph there, isn't it? It's basically saying that, you know, the outer shield of oblivion, which is the entire universe of space and time and individuality, which is the IST and my favorite acronym of GIST, is really nothing more than, you know, an outer, a backup defense system for the guilt that it's the ego's primary thing it doesn't want to look at, which is the G in the GIST acronym. And but none of it's real. It's all made up, but we need to deal with it on the level that we think we're at and in terms of our behavior. But on the level of mind, moment to moment, we can chew gum and walk. We can carry on conversations that seem to be sometimes more or less superficial, sometimes more or less related to truth as we've come to think of it using our polarizing and divisive dualistic language. But there's this growing awareness over time that makes it more and more gentle and easy for us to let go of that investment in the belief in separate interests. Do you want to read the next paragraph, Lynn?
Sure. So Jesus is clearly speaking to a mind that is living out of the effects of its decision to substitute, quote, illusion for truth and, quote, fragmentation for wholeness. He could not be talking to us as bodies because he knows bodies are nothing more than projections of the mind and therefore are lifeless. Lifeless.
That's not how we usually think of it, though, do we?
No, but when you start seeing it that way, it really, it's like, it's pretty darn amazing. And that's kind of clarity that I've been seeing lately, which is kind of mind-blowing when you think about it. Because I never imagined that I would actually be able to see that. In fact, I imagine that I would never be able to see that. And so it's pretty cool to me that, you know, these things are coming to me in a much clearer way now. And I do honestly believe, Bruce, and, you know, maybe other people have different different experiences. But as many times as I have done the workbook lessons, last year I did them in a much more focused way than I had ever before, because I was doing them every day with Lewis, and it became like, you know, that generalized into so much of my life. I really think that shifted me in a way that makes me much more capable of just knowing the truth. Yeah. Versus the untruth. I mean, it's mm-hmm. the untruth is so obvious now, and I can't get caught up and caught into it. And in fact, you were talking about that movie, Inception. Something that's happened to me that is really bizarre, or it seems really bizarre to, you know, if it doesn't happen to you, and if it does happen to you, it makes perfect sense. Is that even when I am sleeping and dreaming? In my dreams, I will suddenly have a realization, oh, this is not real. I'm dreaming. Mm-hmm. And when I have that sudden realization in the dream, I wake up. I don't do the lucid dreaming like people talk about lucid dreaming. I've never been able to do the lucid dreaming because the minute I recognize that I'm dreaming, I wake up. Uh-huh. And I don't know that, I think that Jesus even says that to us. Hear about this world dream. Once you realize you're dreaming, you wake up. Mm-hmm. You can't help it. That's natural. And so, you know, unless you want to keep dreaming, and you know, there are people that, oh yeah, I want to keep dreaming, and I want to, you know, I want to experience flying in this dream, and I want to experience this and that. Me, no. The minute I recognize I'm dreaming, I want to wake up. I'm like, why am I making up this story? And I actually say that to myself in the dream. Why am I making up this story? This has nothing to do with anything. And once I realize it, boom, it's gone. Same thing with any imagination or thought about, I used to, like, if I would be going to a workshop or something, I would imagine what the people were going to be like. I would imagine what I was going to wear. I would imagine myself sitting in the room. I would imagine myself talking to people and being eloquent and intelligent. You know, I had all these imaginary thoughts and plans in my mind and dreams about what I think was going to be and how it was going to work. And, I just, since I began to realize that is all just absolute hogwash. That's just all it's doing is keeping me in an imaginary world and dreaming. It's just influencing my continuation to agree to this thought system that is completely useless, worthless, and has no meaning. You know, once I hit that point, it's like, I really honestly feel like nothing can fool me now, mm-hmm. which is, again, you know, I may be completely wrong, and, there may be a lot of things fooling me now. I'm sure there are. But, I'm sitting in a chair talking to you on a computer. So, yeah.
we can forgive that foolishness, right?
But I also have my suspicions about it.
Is there anybody on the other end of this line?
I'm not completely fooled, but but you know, just somewhere in between. So Jesus is clearly speaking to me, obviously, a mind that is living out of the effects of its decision to substitute illusion for truth. So he says, all that is important to recover our awareness of ourselves as minds. All that is important to helping us to recover our awareness of ourselves as minds. Given our investment in separation and fragmentation, it appears we are individual decision-making minds, different one from another. And it is not wrong to think this at the beginning stages of one's work with the Course. But the natural outcome of practicing forgiveness is the gradual dissolving of this sense that we are separate from each other, which means we will be moving back in the direction of oneness. First, in terms of recognizing we all share a common interest, and then in realizing we share the same identity as God's Son. And see, I think that's it. You know, we're all doing the same. We are all here for the same person, for the same reason, and we are the same identity. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. At this level of correction, we would know there's only one mind. We no longer would be choosing to substitute fragmentation for wholeness and illusion for truth, and therefore we would gradually accept oneness as the truth and experience separation as less and less attractive. Question number 663 also discusses this issue and cites relevant passages in the Course. So that's it. At this level, right, you know, at this point, you know, I'm, like I said, you know, I'm suspicious of, my own thinking. Because I even recognize something's not right here.
Could there be a foreign thought system involved? Could there be a belief system afoot that isn't in my best interests? Yes. I wonder.
And is there a belief system that is in my best interest? Belief itself. Uh-huh. As Dove always says, there's a lie in the middle of it. Belief.
Yeah.
You know, it is just an idea. It's just an idea. Right. And it's neither right nor wrong. It just is non-existent.
Yeah, yeah. And ultimately, I think that, and there's numerous places in the Course and places like Ken Wapnick's material where it's brought out that, you know, the Holy Spirit and forgiveness and the thought system of undoing guilt also is a fiction, but it's a happy fiction, and it's one that will take us all the way back to that threshold where, as the Course says, God takes the final step, and you know, that's kind of, you know, advanced curriculum stuff, and we don't really need to bother with that at this point. We need to, you know, to focus on love and perfect oneness and all that, and truth and all that kind of stuff, all those things that are above the line in Ken's classic chart is you know, fine and dandy, but you know, it's essentially they're sort of diversionary you know, ego tactics for not looking at what's in front of us. Typically, at least that's what I've been experiencing a lot more and more.
Yes.
is that if we can just look at our resistance to, well, you gave a perfect example, Lynn, today of you know, your expectations around going to the retreat in Canyon City today with Brigitte and everyone, and I'm looking at, you know, all the things that have happened in my life as I think of it over this past year, and will probably continue to unfold, and all the things that I thought would be happening about this time, and what's happening in actuality, and again with the actual with a little grin about the word actuality, you know, to just look at the things that seem to be occurring in our dream of a life, and like you say, you know, seeing that the puppet figures that we've invested in are not worth anything more than just a gentle laughter, and a reminder that that's our classroom, and the classroom can be a gentle undoing of that investment in a thought system and in a belief system that doesn't serve us. And the opposite thought system really is just the undoing of what never was. So it's not really any more real than the unreality of the belief in separation. But because it undoes that, we do have moments of peace where we let go, and we don't have to do it all at once because that's too scary. But and, you know, unless if you're listening to this program right now, you probably don't have any need to hear what we're saying, and maybe you're just gently amused at the whole thing. But most of the time we have, you know, a gradual awakening over many decades, certainly years and decades, and usually lifetimes, it would seem. But it's all fine. We do get the gradual process of the gentle approach of looking, like that paragraph you just read says, share a common interest, recognize that we all share a common interest, and then in realizing we share the same identity as God's son. So we go from shared interest to shared identity in a slow, gradual process of looking at our expectations, looking at our disappointments, looking at our victimhoods and upsets and grievances and imagined illnesses and misfortunes and you know, turns of events that are not to our liking and all that stuff, and just say, wow, that's a pretty impressive dream you got going there, student production studio of the mind, huh?
Well, and it is. It seems so complex and so,
oh, yeah,
so intelligent and beautiful. And everybody, oh my gosh, yeah, it just seems so bright. But then, but every single bit of it, it just falls apart when you really look at it. Mm-hmm. It is really, honestly, like it's just made out of something that is just not, well, it is. It's made out of dream stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why people get upset when they start recognizing this, because the things that they thought were real begin to just, you know, they just see, oh, that's not, that couldn't be. How could that be? And once you start seeing that and questioning it, then it falls apart more and more. And unless you have developed this structure and this relationship, this is for me anyway, essential, is this relationship that I have with Jesus or the Holy Spirit, God, whatever you want to call this, you know, whatever being that you mentioned earlier, the thing about the nostalgia, it's a remembered feeling. It's a remembered knowing. Mm-hmm. And we all have that. Richard, yep, Rose talks about that a lot. I don't know if you've ever read Richard Rose, but his whole thing is that it's a nostalgia, and it is that calling. It's the voice of heaven. It's that faraway song that we hear and we remember, and then the things around us begin to remind us of that more and more. And that for me, you know, music and you know, art and just looking at things and looking at people and being around people, it begins to remind me of my own holiness. Mm-hmm. And it is my holiness that is really the thing that moves this. And it's not who I am that is changing. It is who I really am that is being awakened or brought forth or allowed to shine through that shield of oblivion. And sometimes it comes out in a very odd way, and you know, you begin to recognize that you can't personally, I can't agree with anything that I see in the world now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, seriously, there's nothing I can agree with. I've gotten out of thinking about politics because there's all of it is a sham. Thinking about money, all of it is a sham. Thinking about religion or society, culture, everything I see is just, it's so obvious to me how we made it up and how
right.
it was made up for a certain purpose. And that purpose was not, believe it or not, the salvation of the world or the return of us to our true identity. All of it is actually made to prevent me from returning to my true identity and to keep me grounded in the world. And so it's all purposeful. But the purpose of it is not the purpose that I want. And so as I begin to see more and more and more that, you know, this meeting, this, you know, going, you know, hearing a person speak, and, you know, I'm sure, you know, Brent Haskell, and he has some new channeling that came through. And I'm looking at that thinking, well, what could he be hearing that I'm not hearing? What, I mean, I could almost guarantee you I'm going to go there and he's going to say exactly the same thing I'm saying right now. Something of that nature, because... You know, we're one mind and the truth is true no matter what. And, you know, if he's not saying something like, which he has before, you know, give up your quest, stop thinking that somehow or the other you have an influence over making yourself into this holy son of God. You don't. You're already that. You have an influence in making yourself into this thing you're not. And you do have an influence in that and you can stop it. So, you know,
I'm laughing only because I was, as you're saying, your quest, it reminded me of that silly scene in the first Monty Python movie, the Holy Grail movie, where the King Arthur and his men are, you know, traipsing along this mountain trail with clanging of coconuts together to simulate the sound of horses' hooves, right? And they come upon this ogre-looking figure who says, "What is your quest?"
Yes.
Remember that scene?
Yeah, I love that scene.
And depending on how they answer, they're all but the, you know, the last one, I think, is hurled through, not by him, but hurled by their own thinking into the abyss, right? And this treacherous mountain pass. But I think that's kind of symbolic. You know, I never thought of it that way until just this moment. It's like, you know, as long as we have the quest be fixing the dream and making what we do and don't do, whether we get to go to certain retreats or have the outcome of, you know, going to a memorial like I'm going to do this afternoon turn out a certain way, and, you know, seeing old neighbors I haven't seen in 40 years and things like that, you know, have those, I'm anticipating interactions with those people and like, well, gee, will they turn out the way I want them to turn out? You know, it's like, well, it's all that stuff, you know, every single bit of our life as a classroom. And like you were saying, we can be gentle with ourselves as we allow ourselves to include more and more of that, and to generalize more and more, and realize that it has nothing to do with behavior. And there's nothing wrong with having preferences and saying, well, I prefer to do this versus that. But once we go cross the line of thinking, well, it's what I do or don't do in the world is important, then we're hurled into that metaphoric abyss, aren't we? We're just basically back in the trenches of ego's thought system of fear. And you know, attack and suffering and the whole guilt that founded it. But all we have to do is you know, have the only answer that really makes sense within the context of the world, and it takes countless forms, is to forgive. And that's what lets us pass. That's when we our will is to see our brother sinless, rather than, you know, emphasizing on whether or not we see him as a body. Of course we're going to see, you know, each other as bodies. I mean, that's what we came here with. You know, we built this elaborate you know, holographic 3D award, beyond award winning production to make a big deal out of it. But it's just a hologram. It's just a cartoon of incredible depth and precision and from the microscopic to the macroscopic. But it's a cartoon.
What can you expect? You made it up. And
really?
You spoke about Monty Python. We can go a few minutes over if you don't mind.
Oh, okay, sure.
The Monty Python thing, I use that. I think about that too when I think about this false identity, because remember they come into the place where the villagers are getting ready to do a trial for a witch.
Right, right, right.
And they have this girl and they got her tied up and they have like put a carrot on her face for a nose and they were saying she's a witch, and they were saying, how do you know she's a witch? Well, she is. Look at her. Look, she has a witch's nose. And the girl goes, you put that on me, it's false, you know. And I think
that's a great one too. I hadn't thought of that metaphor. That's great. Yeah.
You know, all the measurements that I have that are going to prove that you're this evil thing, I made it up.
Yeah, yeah. You know what that reminds me of is I took some classes that I really enjoyed from, I think, led into my interest in this. And it turns out that the instructor, years later, I discovered was a course student, Charles Tart, who's a fellow who brought the phrase altered states of consciousness into the public mainstream through his work in you know, depth psychology and transpersonal psychology and a whole lot of different arenas. But anyway, one of the things that he did, I went back to Davis on like an open house day years later, and I was sharing with him how much his classes meant to me. And one of the things he was drawing for, and I sat in one of his classes, you know, as a postgraduate from that school, and he was drawing on the whiteboard there. He said, well, here's how we look at reality. And he drew this curved line. It was just had a slight curve to it, but you could notice it was a curve, kind of like the carrot that was put on the witch, quote unquote, in your example, and so in the process of doing that, he says, well, now to prove that's straight, I'm gonna show you a ruler, and he draws this slightly curved ruler that exactly matches the curvature of the line he drew above it. And she says, see, I've just proved that it's a straight line.
Yes.
I thought, that's what a great metaphor for how we use our illusions to prove themselves to us. But it's no more real than, you know, putting a wilted carrot on a woman's nose and saying, see, there's proof that she's a witch, you know. And that Monty Python film. Yeah,
that exactly. Is pretty funny, yeah. And so we do that all the time. And you know, that's and once you recognize that you're doing it, then you can either, which for me, you know, it took a while to actually say, okay, yes, I am doing that, and now I have to stop, and now I have to stop, and now I have to actually look at people or look at things in the world and recognize that I'm the one who's given them all the meaning that they have.
Yes. Yes.
And so, you know, if I think that, you know, if I think anybody is doing or thinking anything, I'm the one who made that up.
Right.
I'm not privy to their mind. Mm-hmm. I'm not privy to their thought process. I mean, Jesus pretty well knows, because, you know, he knows the ego thought system. It's all the same. All ego thoughts are equally untrue.
Yes.
There is no order of difficulty in miracles. And that's something I try to point out in my little post on that, the things that people were writing about the Ramana Maharshi quote, you know, you're making this up and all of it is equally untrue. But I'm also recognizing that they're writing those things because I'm thinking those things. And now is a time for me to look at my own thoughts and clear them up. Not to clear up their thoughts,
exactly.
Clear up my mind. Because
exactly.
Obviously I wouldn't be seeing it if it wasn't something in my mind. That's
huge. Lynn, you just figured it out. It's all your problem. It's not mine.
So yeah, you let me figure it out and the world will be as one, you know.
but that's it. You just hit on it perfectly. It all brings it back to where we do have a choice, and that's then the choice of, you know, either ego's thought system or letting go of it. You know, it's a course in not know. It's a course in undoing our investment in those seeming differences and those orders of difficulty and all that stuff. Do we have time to read the last couple of paragraphs?
Yeah, let's go ahead.
Okay, all right. Death is a decision made by a mind for either a right-minded or a wrong-minded purpose. There's those two thought systems again. In other words, it is part of the continuum of the mind's ongoing decision either to uphold the illusion of separation or to undo it. The mind is not in the body, so the mind is not changed in any way by when the body dies. It is affected only by its own choices. From this perspective, death is irrelevant, although from the perspective of the world, clearly it is not. So I'm not going to, you know, spout off the idea that death is irrelevant when I go to this memorial service this afternoon, for example. See questions number 68 and 494 for further discussion and references. You want to read the last paragraph?
Yeah, go ahead. I'll read it. So and yes, you're not going to spout that out when you go to that funeral, because A, you really don't know that.
Yeah.
I mean, you can say those words, but you really don't know that death is not real. Or you may, and I don't know, you know, but in reality, yeah, the evidence before us is pretty clear that, you know, Uncle George or whomever is no longer going to speak to me. Although when my sister died a couple of years ago, they did her so well. She looked like she could just sit up. She looked like she was just going to sit up and talk to us in that coffin. It was so weird. But this is, you know, how do you come to know this? And, you know, of course we all want to know this. Of course we want to know the thing that is the most terrifying to you in this world is not real. You want to have that assurance that it is not real. And that's why the whole demonstration of Jesus, the crucifixion and all that. But it even goes further than that, because Jesus was not identified with that body, and that body, you know, he actually was projecting it, and he knew he was projecting, and he was doing it purposely. I am projecting it. I'm doing it purposely, and I don't know that I'm doing it purposely, and therefore is coming to know my own mind and my own purpose. That really makes the huge difference. If I know my own mind, then I can see, oh, the purpose I'm projecting this body is for, you know, right now, many, many things. But eventually, as we become more aligned with the Holy Spirit thought system, then you do recognize the purpose that you're projecting the body for, and you don't use it for any other reason. You don't use it to hurt people. You don't use it to guilt people. You don't use it to pleasure yourself. You don't use it for any reason other than the only purpose that really it does have is to, you know, bring about the awakening and the salvation of the world. Yeah. And
I think the way the Course describes it as a wholly neutral thing. It's such a great insight, because it basically, if it's wholly neutral, then what isn't neutral? Well, the only things that aren't neutral are the little two-position switch in our mind that's either switched to the ego's belief system or switched away from it. And if it's switched away from it, then the purpose shifts dramatically. It becomes it's merely a mechanism by which we awaken from a mortal dream.
That's it.
And a dream that's fearful and that's you know, motivated by guilt, you know, which of course doesn't exist in truth.
Exactly.
But we don't know that. We don't know that until we look at all the specifics that it seems to, you know, the dream seems to hurl at us, but they're really coming from our mind. But that's how we discover that it's coming from our mind, is by looking at them with our inner kindness teacher. Yeah.
And so, you know, the reason that Jesus keeps telling us over and over and over, look at your mind, look at your thinking, look at it, look at it, look at it, is because when you look at it, it does become clear to you. If you look at it without judgment, you know, as long as you're looking at it with the judgment, then it's going to be whatever you want it to be. But when you look at it neutrally without judgment, then you begin to see the actual, you know, purpose of everything. And it makes so much sense. So this last paragraph then, this also brings up a lot of stuff that people don't people believe. And Joel Goldsmith, I've been listening to a lot of Joel Goldsmith, he's clear about this too, that your believing in all these other things is keeping you from believing in the truth. Your beliefs and all these other things are keeping you from actually seeing the truth. So this last paragraph is going to talk about a little of this. To ask whether we carry with us what we learn in this lifetime is to assume that time is linear, and A Course in Miracles teaches that it is not. We always have to return to the reference point of a mind that is outside time and space, deciding between two teachers and their thought systems. It is very humbling to be asked to disregard our experience as a reference point for understanding issues like these, but we must really raise ourselves to Jesus's level if we are going to make progress in understanding his teachings. And this elevation of thought, this raising of our thought to this higher level, to look out above the battleground, to look out above the world, and to recognize that you don't have to be thinking and fearing from within. You can actually see it from a different level and hang out with Jesus and watch the world and watch your body, watch your reactions, because the mind goes on. The ego mind goes on. The ego mind continues to chatter. The ego mind continues to want. The ego mind continues to be afraid. The ego mind, it continues with all those things because that's its nature. And it is not you, and it is not your nature. Its nature is to preserve the body, preserve the life of the world, preserve itself as it knows it self to be, because it knows that if it doesn't do that, continue to preserve it, that you will destroy it just simply by looking at it and recognizing it's not real. It has to continually to build these facades and keep them as impeccable as possible so that you don't see the ruse. So you know, it's continuing to do that. We're continuing in the meantime, to align ourselves with a mind that can see that this is not true and not real, and therefore can walk away from it without a sense of loss or fear. Walk away from the world without believing that you've lost anything. There's no sacrifice here. Nothing is lost because you made it up in the first place. You can't lose what you already have. You can't lose what came from you. You can't, I mean, it's all, it's all in your own mind. You know, he's saying it's really humbling to be asked to disregard our experience. But we must raise ourselves if we're going to be able to do this. Time and space are part of the ego's strategy to convince us that we are bodies, to substitute fragmentation for wholeness, as quoted above. The learning takes place only on the level of the decision-making mind outside time and space, and it is essentially learning that its choice for the thought system of separation was a mistake, which can now be corrected. And that's all we're doing. We're just correcting our mistaken beliefs. And the only way you can do that is by looking at it, recognizing the mistake, just like a math problem. Look at it, recognize the mistake, and fix it.
Yeah. It's the three R's all over again, isn't it?
Yep.
I think that's such a handy shortcut. We reveal to ourselves that ego's belief system isn't working for us. We release our investment in it by just allowing, again, both these first steps done with that elevated awareness that we all have, that we took with us into the dream, that says, oh yeah, I'm not this separate self. I'm actually a mind that can choose against my worst interests and say, you know what, I think I could choose peace instead of this. And then the third step, the third R of the reveal, release, replace, process, we just get the heck out of the way. We don't have to do anything. That's why in the text it says, you know, your participation is not involved. In fact, if you try to get involved, that usually means that you still got an ego investment in trying to fix the dream. And, you know, we put our dream repair technician hat back on, and and you look up and see the little brim of that hat sticking over. It's like, oh yeah, I guess I'm trying to fix the dream again.
Yeah. Oh, and the other thing that I think is really important to remember is that at any moment, at any time, you can choose that. And it it's not like, you know, oh gosh, I'm dreaming. Like I'm sleeping and I'm dreaming. I'm sleeping and I recognize, oh, I'm making up a story. I'm dreaming. At any moment, I can stop that. I don't have to get, and just because other people seem to be caught up in the story and other people seem to be caught up in the drama or the fear or whatever that seems to be going on, I don't have to be caught up in it. I can watch it just like, you know, you go to a movie and you watch a movie, you know, you can choose to either get, you know, caught up in it and believe it and be afraid and worried. And that is entertainment for the ego. It's just, you know, it's showing you, oh, wow, you know, here's how you could be in danger. Here's how, you know, it really, you know, but you're not in danger. You're sitting in a seat watching a movie. Mm-hmm. You know, that tsunami is not coming to get you. You know, those zombies are not coming after you. None of these things are happening. You're sitting in a theater watching a movie and you are completely safe. Yeah. So, and you can know that at any moment. And in that moment that you know that, then you are actually empowered and free to act and react in the way that is most helpful to whatever the situation is.
Right.
And just remember that you're here to be truly helpful and you're here to represent the Christ who sent you. You don't have to think about what you're going to say or what you're going to do, because the Christ who sent you will direct you. And you can be just content to be here wherever he wishes, knowing that he's right here with you. And you will be healed as you learn to heal. And this is, I mean, that simple little prayer from page 28, it says it all. It says it all. Here's the way you behave in a world where everything else is insane. Here's the way you act, you think, you feel. And when you are in that place where you're just here to be truly helpful, then you can actually act and react in a helpful way that really does have some meaning. You're not just adding to the chaos.
Exactly. And that truly helpfulness, because minds are shared and there nothing really leaves its source, can be a reminder that we can afford to be gentle with ourselves and with each other when we have those lapses in mindfulness. When we seem to have lapses in that generalization that you're addressing so nicely, Lynn, that you know, when we forget and then we do make outcomes of events in the world a big deal, and we can just kind of say, oh yeah, there I go again. And rather than doing a number on ourselves or anyone else, for that matter, just begin to shorten the gap of time between that triggering awareness and then the time between the revelation and the release, between when we reveal and release our grip on that dysfunctional thought system, and we see the purpose of nature of it, and we can see that. That no matter how long we've, you know, been beating ourselves up, nothing happened. You know, not one note in heaven's song was missed. We never were able to destroy perfect oneness, and we do that through the shared interest that excellent FAQ we just read addresses so nicely. So anyway, I just have a couple of. I know we've run way over, but I'm just going to remind people about the Weekend of Freedom Retreat that's happening in Estes Park, Colorado, June 16th through the 19th of this year, which is 2016. And you can go to weekendoffreedomretreat.org or .com and find more about that. I'm Again, speaking of expectations and outcomes, I'm planning to be there. As far as I know, I'll be there. And along with Gary Renard, Cindy Laura Renard, I just did an interview with Gary and Cindy this past week, and I put it up on that website and also on ACIM blog. And just before that, in May, a little closer to your neck of the Dream Woods, Lynn, Lynn Corona and Tim Wise are going to be doing another retreat in Colorado Springs area. And you can go to sfacim.org, which is the School for A Course in Miracles.org, and learn about that one. That's happening May 1st through the 4th, 1st through the 4th at the Franciscan Retreat Center in Colorado Springs. And so there's the one in May in Colorado Springs for 4 days, and then there's the one in Estes Park in June. The 16th through the 19th for 4 days. So if you know someone in Colorado or you live there or plan to be there, two great events to check out that are course related and both highly recommended. So.
Oh, I love it. And that Franciscan Retreat Center is where we had our fall retreat. It's beautiful. It's just a gorgeous place. So if Lynn and Tim are going to be there, I would love to get up there love to hear from Lynn Corona. I think I want to try to get a hold of her and see if she'd be interested in doing a mini series. We're doing mini series now. We're getting teachers who will commit to 3 to 8 Sundays in a row. So they would come in on Sunday evening for an hour and do some continuing teaching, maybe something that has a theme or something. But I want to talk to Lynn about maybe doing one of those mini series for us. And
that sounds like fun.
I think a lot of people would enjoy it. And there's a lot of folks who are, you know, love her from the Endeavor Academy, as she was known as Angel by the master teacher, and was very well respected amongst that organization, those people. So I think we'd have a lot of folks that are in this room who would love to hear from her. So,
and Tim Wise is a wonderful fellow student and teacher, of course. I've attended a bunch of his classes and gatherings, and he always has great stuff to share too. He's obviously studied a course for a long time as well, and shares it in a very gentle, lighthearted way, with a lot of depth as well. So yeah, great stuff.
Very cool. All right, Bruce, I love you, brother.
Likewise.
And thank you so much for taking some extra time with me.
Thank you, Lynn.
I'm supposed to be meditating right now, but you know, you can meditate later or.
So we'll ask for forgiveness instead of permission for going over you. have a great week, all.
All right. I love you, Bruce. I'll send you this recording. Bye-bye.